Welcome to the AI podcast. I'm Paul Lay, senior editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm delighted to say that today I'm joined by Dr. Nicholas Wright, who is one of the world's leading neuroscientists who researches the brain, but also researches security and technology. He holds positions at University College London, advises the Pentagon Joint Staff, and is at the Georgetown Center for Strategic and International Studies, as well as the National Defense University in the United States. So welcome, Nicholas.
Paul, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. I think we can call you genuinely a polymath. It's an overused word, but I think in your case it's accurate.
Or maybe a bimath. There we go.
Well, trimath, I think, according to the introduction anyway. But Nicholas is the author of a really stimulating, fascinating book called Warhead, How the Brain Shapes War and War Shapes the Brain, in which he combines those ideas of neuroscience, of technology, and security. It's a really fascinating argument that you have there, that basically the brain is built for conflict, that it is, as you argue, the central weapon of war. And before we get to that journey through the brain that's very much at the centre of Warhead, your book, I just wonder if you could talk about how you got to this position, because it's a fairly remarkable career you've had, and it's one that leads us to the very cutting edge of technology now with artificial intelligence as well, which is a key component of this, which no doubt we'll come to later. But I wonder if you could give us a brief potted biography of that journey you've made.
Yeah, oh, well, Paul, thank you so much for asking. So, yes, so I was a medical doctor. So I practiced medicine, treated patients, in particular patients with brain disorders. And I did that in Oxford and also at a place in London called Queen's Square, which has got a neurology hospital there and lots of research institutes all around this sort of lovely sort of leafy green square.
Not I know
far
it
from
well.
Where we are
I know
now.
It well.
Yeah. And I was always fascinated by the brain. And so I then took time out from my medical work and did a PhD and then further research. And I used functional brain imaging and other technologies to look at how humans make decisions about things like rewards and punishments, risks, social motivations, and so on. And it was an incredibly exciting time where we were learning so much about the brain. And so, for example, some people then went off and applied that to things like AI. So Demis Hassabis, who won last year's Nobel Prize in AI. So he and I shared an office for a little bit. We had desks in the same office whilst he was finishing his PhD and I was starting mine. And so he applied, you know, fascinating new ideas about the brain to AI, right? And Geoffrey Hinton, who won the other Nobel Prize in AI last year, he set up two doors down the Gatsby Computational Neuroscience Unit. And so Queen Square is really the heart of this hubbub of ideas about how the brain works. And I really wanted to apply it. I was always fascinated by history and security, and I really wanted to apply this to these ideas about the brain to international security. And so I got a fellowship to go to Washington, D.C., where I worked at a think tank, the Carnegie Endowment, and I looked at nuclear strategy. So how humans make decisions about nuclear weapons, because right at the center of everything to do with nuclear deterrence, right, is the center of that is affecting how other people make decisions. It's about small numbers of individuals and how they make decisions. And so the brain is absolutely central, and they were very interested. People who worked there at places like the Pentagon and so on, very interested in these ideas. And I got to know people in the Pentagon Joint Staff, and, you know, they saw value in what I was doing. And I've been working with the Joint Staff, advising them in the Pentagon for over a decade now. And I still conduct neuroscience research. And I guess the reason why I've now written this book, so I advise the Pentagon, I advise SAP, for example, which is Europe's largest tech company, and, you know, I advise the British Ministry of Defence and so on. But the reason I wanted to write this book that's for a much more general audience is that what I don't think most people understand now is that we're in a very different historical time than we were 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And what I don't think people understand, and this is something that I see in the Pentagon, in my work with the Pentagon all the time, is we could fight a very, very major war that is involving really high-end military, conventional warfare in East Asia, in the Middle East, and in Europe, all at the same time. That is, to all intents and purposes, a world war next. That's what people are genuinely really really worried about. And the other thing to remember is that we could lose. Mm. We are no longer overwhelmingly militarily superior in the West. We could lose. And that's not hyperbole. This isn't something they say to get more funding.
Yeah.
They really worry about this. And I think they're right to worry about it, particularly if it's a prolonged war, because right now China produces more manufacturing stuff than the next 4 or maybe even 9 countries in the world combined. They are very good at manufacturing. They now have more robots per industrial worker than any G7 country. They're not just manufacturing a lot of stuff. They're in many ways better at manufacturing than we are, than the Germans are, than the Japanese are. People just do not understand this. And if we are going to avoid losing, and hopefully it won't come to this.
And when you mean we, you mean, Western
West.
Liberal democracies.
Yeah. If we are going to avoid losing, then we have to understand the central weapon of war, which has always been the human brain. We have no choice because we will be outmatched in many aspects of just sheer volume of material that they have, drones, robots, all the rest of it. If we must fight, then we need to understand ourselves so that we won't lose, that we will win. And also, I think we need to understand ourselves better as humans so that we can hopefully avoid war and hopefully avoid war escalating. So we need to understand why humans fight as well. So we need to understand why humans fight, lose, and win wars. And I'm optimistic. I don't want this to be a pessimistic podcast. I want it to be an optimistic podcast because I'm really optimistic because I think that we can know so much more about ourselves than we've ever known before. And I think we can get to a more peaceful world through self-knowledge. We can never abolish war, but we can get to a more peaceful world through self-knowledge. And I think that's really crucial for people to know about now, the concerned citizen, as well as the people deep in the bowels of the Pentagon or, you know, underneath the Ministry of Defence in London.
And you were quite prescient in predicting this precarious new world that we have. You talk about going back to 2019, 2020, when there was still a reluctance to really imagine what has happened in Ukraine, for example.
I mean, I would love to take the credit for that, obviously, and
we'll
I do take the credit. No, I mean, I think that once you start looking at what machines we have in the West, what ways we think about war, how we think about warfare, how we think about fighting in the West, in Britain, in America, in France, in Germany, and how they think about it in China. So I've done work with China's top university, which is Peking University. I've done research out there, and you know, and I spent a lot of time thinking about all of these things. And when you just lay everything side by side, you realize that we are no longer overwhelmingly militarily superior.
Yeah. No.
And not only that, but for example, when you go to China and you go to China's top university, which is Peking University, right, it's where Mao Zedong was a librarian, right? And across the road is Tsinghua, where China's current paramount leader, Xi Jinping, went to university, right? Mm-hmm. Where I've also done things. They are extremely good at stuff. Peking University is not quite as good as UCL. Now I would say it, wouldn't I? But it's not quite as good as UCL. But it is, for example, a better university than any university in the whole of the European Union.
Yeah.
It's very important to remember that. There is not one university in the European Union, the whole of the European Union, that is as good, certainly as Peking University and probably also as Tsinghua University. It's not quite fair because I was funded by the Max Planck Institute. It's a little bit different in France and Germany. They have these different postgraduate institutes. They're very good at science. They're very good at technology. And their manufacturing is absolutely colossal. And once you start understanding that, right, and also that they just simply do not have the same ideas about the world as us, right, in every way. Mm. Like, I grew up in North London. It was very pleasant, ultimately. I grew up in Finchley. It was nice. Xi Jinping grew up during the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah.
There's, you know, you read the story. Xi Jinping, as a young man, he's, you know, his father was a very senior official in the Communist Party. And Xi Jinping, his father falls from grace. Xi Jinping goes, he's hungry. He goes to his mother to ask for food. He's trying to speak to her through the window, and she turns him away because she's terrified that, you know, this will reflect badly upon her. He's sent out to the countryside. That's the reality of how he grew up. And I know
it gives you a certain drive.
I mean, there are lots of people who I have met, you know, senior people who were in the Chinese nuclear weapons, you know, edifice. You know, spent time going around meeting people from the Central Military Commission and other people in Beijing, right? They just simply do not have the same understanding of the world that we had.
And how would you differentiate that understanding?
I think that, so for example, the major difference between, I met nobody in China who wasn't what would in the sort of Western sort of international relations literature would be described as a realist, in the sense that they thought that power was the number one thing in world politics. That doesn't mean you shouldn't use your power benignly. That doesn't mean you shouldn't be magnanimous. It doesn't mean you shouldn't be a beneficent leader or whatever it is. But there was absolutely no doubt that the idea that the whole world... Now, I don't completely agree with that. I think the whole world does... like norms are very important, all the rest of it. They simply thought America was number one because America had more stuff than everybody else and was very good at stuff and its allies were. And that's the reality of the thing. And that's how they understood the world. And that is... it's not everything at all, but it is... that is a good chunk of how the world works. Mm. And once you understand all of that, you don't have to be too prescient. It's just that I'd went to see things and speak to people and do things that were different to what everybody else did. Now, equally, they don't know what neuroscientists and psychiatrists and all the wonderful things that we, you know, we research in different ways here. And I think that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, was to try and bring these two worlds together. Mm. Right? Mm. Because if we're going to, you know, survive and thrive in this new world, which I think and hopefully, you know, we can and we will, then we need to be smart. Mm. And beyond just being clever, we also need to be wise, which I hope is something we have time to go on to.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And when you address, I mean, you, what you've just described, I mean, the importance of Lenin's dictum, I suppose, imbibed by Chinese leaders, which is the old maxim of whom, I suppose, of Lenin's great and very perceptive dictum.
I'm not saying we're all doomed, we're all definitely going to war. That is absolutely not the case. So, for example, can we deter Xi Jinping from launching a war in Taiwan? Now, ultimately, he is the paramount leader of China. He is the most powerful leader of China since Mao Zedong. If Xi Jinping, whatever his intentions are, and we have very sophisticated brain machinery for working out other people's intentions, if his intention is to launch that invasion will launch. I mean, it's as simple as that, because he is extremely powerful, right, within the Chinese system. We don't know if he's definitely going to do that. How can we influence his decision-making? How can we make him stop and hopefully not do that? Is he deterrable? Now, if you again then look at someone like Vladimir Putin, for example, is Vladimir Putin deterrable? So here's a hypothetical, which, to put it mildly, a lot of people are thinking about in capitals around Europe and elsewhere. If there is a major war in East Asia between America and China, probability of which is far from zero, over somewhere like Taiwan, if, and we're assuming here now that the Ukraine war, so Vladimir Putin has managed to reconstitute the Russian military to a reasonable degree, the Ukraine war is largely settled. I think it's an open question as to whether we could deter him from launching a major military invasion of the Baltic Republics and or Poland. Mm. Right? I don't think that's a particularly controversial view. America physically will not have things in Europe anymore because they will physically have had to go to East Asia. Mm. How do we fight in Poland, in the Baltic Republics? Right now, you get then to all of these different issues. Who then? Humans need leaders, individual leaders. Without the Americans there, who is going to be the leader amongst these Europeans? The French, the British, the Germans? How are the Poles going to feel having a German commanding their tank divisions? Because this is literally where we're going. Mm. What's going to be the purpose of the British armored division that we will send? Almost certainly. The purpose of that division is to anchor the British nuclear deterrent into that conventional war with Russia. All of these things, everything I've been talking about, politics, the identity of those British soldiers, those British soldiers, and a lot of them will, you know, will die. That's the reality of what will happen in a high-end war with Russia. Those soldiers, their identity as British people is what will anchor our nuclear deterrent to that conflict. So then that's about identity. It's about who they are. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's, again, a fundamentally human thing. None of what I've talked about, how can we try and deter Vladimir Putin? What are his intentions? What does he perceive? What does he want to do as the leader in Russia? And I think, again, he wants to be the great. If there was a war in East Asia and the Americans were simply not able to do very much in Europe, I think that he probably is undeterrable from launching a conventional war. Again, that's something people don't like to think about.
Yeah.
They haven't thought about. Mm. But all of these things, the centre of all of them, at the heart of everything, is human brains. Mm. And for every listener out there, as a concerned citizen, we have a duty as concerned citizens. We don't need to know everything. Of course we don't. It's all, you know, one of my favourite quotes is, sadly probably apocryphal, like so many quotes these days when you can look on the internet, is, you know, Oscar Wilde, who said the wonderful quote that the problem with socialism is that it takes up too many evenings. Mm. And I just think this is the most wonderful quote because it's true. We're all busy. I mean, no one wants to like read 50 books on war and then take a test on it and all the rest of it, you know. But we need to know enough. We can't pretend it's not going to happen. We can't pretend that it absolutely cannot happen. We just need to know enough about it. And then as concerned citizens and realise that we need to think about it a little bit, enough so that we can prepare a little bit and our society can do what it needs to do in order to defend us. Mm. And I am hopeful, I'm genuinely optimistic that we can do that. And I meet people from Sweden and I meet people from all sorts of different European countries. And I'm very confident that we can build what we need to build in order to defend Europe and prevail in a conflict and do that in a way that doesn't lead to an apocalyptic nuclear exchange, which, of course, is again another thing we want to avoid.
Yes, absolutely. And as you say, the absolutely central to that is the brain, is understanding the brain. And at the centre of your book is what you might describe as a journey through the brain. And it's quite cleverly done as you go back to front, basically. I wonder if you could give us a kind of precis summary of that narrative there, of those different sections of the brain. Because you have basically 10 chapters, don't
yes.
you? Where you divide them into different sections of that brain, which yes. is incredibly illuminating in itself, never mind the security and technological applications of this. But I just wonder if you could briefly take us on that journey.
Yeah, well, you said who whom. The classic Russian thing, who whom. And like, the brain is the centrepiece of the book in many ways, right? It's about brain and the war. But the narrative journey in the book is about going through the brain. So we start right at the very base of the brain, right at the bottom, at what's called the brain stem. So this is the part of the brain that does really basic things like pain, for example, has really important areas for pain and breathing, circulation, right? And if your brain stem dies, you die. Right. Right. So the rest, you can... I remember once there was a postman who was living a perfectly happy and reasonable life, and he had a bit of a headache one day, had a brain scan, basically had only a thin rim of brain all around the top, and most of the rest of it turned into giant blood vessels. You can live without most of the rest of your brain.
But not the brain stem.
If you lose the brain stem, you are dead. Yeah. Right. That is
this is the fundamental basic
exactly.
stuff.
So we start right there at the base, and then we travel through a number of different brain regions, you say, and we end right at the other end of the brain, the bit just behind the forehead, right, which is called the frontal pole. And that's the most distinctively human part of the brain, the bit of the brain that's most different in humans compared to other animals. And that can do some of our most remarkable things, such as the ability to think about our own thinking. Mm-hmm. So the frontal pole can, you can reach in and say, you can make a judgment. Does this tie look nice, right? And then you can think, how confident am I in that judgment? Hmm. You can think about your own thinking.
And this is where we find wisdom.
Well, it's one of the key parts of, yeah, I mean, so yeah, it is. So you look at Socrates on the Temple of Delphi was know thyself, right? Yeah, yeah. If you read ancient Chinese philosophy, self-reflection, introspection, thinking about thinking has always been central to wisdom everywhere and at all times. It's part of the process of wisdom. Now, I'll get on to AI in a bit, and I think it's really important for understanding how we can make AI work better for us. But yes, the frontal pole, this bit right at the front of the brain, is really important for thinking about thinking, and that is really important for the process of wisdom. Now, how does our brain work? So the brain is obviously, it can seem enormously dauntingly complicated, but I think a really simple way of thinking about it is, why do you, Paul, have a brain? Why does any listener out there have a brain? Why do I have a brain? The reason we have a brain is actually very simple. And it's the same for all animals. The reason we have a brain is that we have sensory information coming in. A brain is there to link senses. It's a process that links senses coming in to actions that we can take that can help us achieve our goals. For example, like surviving, getting food or reproducing. And so you don't even need a brain for that. So an amoeba, which you probably remember looking at under a microscope when you were at school, you know, an amoeba, it senses chemical information coming in and then it can make actions, send out pseudopodia and all the rest of it to try and move towards and get to food and eat that food so it can survive. So senses, we have a brain so that we can link senses to actions that help us achieve our goals. Now, in the human brain, what we have is we have lots of those different models. So I call that a model. Right, so we have a model of the world that helps us link senses to actions. And in the human brain, we have many different, all the different brain regions we look at throughout, all the way from the brain stem to the frontal pole, they all give us new and different models. Mm. Right? So to give you an example, these models are not just metaphorical they are literally in there. And we have remarkably sophisticated models of the world, models that we can explore within our own brains that simulate the world around us. So to give you an example is right now, Paul, you have a model of this recording studio, physically, a map, a model of the physical world around you, a map of the world. And that is not metaphorically in there. You literally have a model of the world, of the physical world around you in your brain, in a region called the hippocampal entorhinal region. This is the region that Demis Hassabis, last year's Nobel Prize winner in AI, this is the region he studied when he was doing his PhD. And this model of the, we know it's in there. So we can put a grid of electrodes into a rodent's brain, into this hippocampal entorhinal region, and then we can let the rodent run around, and we can read out exactly where the rodent is in the real world just by reading its map of the brain. Mm. And there are incredible videos where you can see it thinking about, is it going to go left or right in a maze? And you can see its map. It's sweeping through the map in the brain, thinking about where it's going to go. It's incredible videos on the internet. So these models are not metaphors. They're literally in there.
They're real.
And our brain has a whole orchestra of different models. Mm. Things like emotions, like fear. Oh, there's, you know, a threat coming in. What are the actions I can take to respond appropriately to that threat? Or I have models of you, right, of other people. So we have incredibly sophisticated models for example, thinking, what you could call thinking, sitting between senses and actions is what could be called thinking. We have remarkable models for thinking of other people's intentions. So when I talked earlier about Xi Jinping, for example, what is his intention? Or Vladimir Putin, what are his intentions? We humans have large areas of the brain that are really good at working at other people's intentions. And that's not only for working out when they might try and be cheating us, but also that enables us to cooperate, for example. And that's so important to remember, that we are humans are able to cooperate in the way that no other animals can. Mm-hmm. We can cooperate across a wider range of circumstances than any other animals in the whole world. And that's because we can model others' intentions, and so we can keep track of what they're doing and what they might do, so that we can cooperate them with when we can, but they're also not going to, you know, defect or screw us if they so choose, right? And we can balance these different risks, mm-hmm. and that helps us get the benefits of cooperation. So we have all of these remarkable different brain systems, and they work together as an orchestra. Right?
Yeah, I like your metaphor or analogy of the orchestra.
Thank you. And then right, the conductor of our orchestra, and just to say, you know, we have like things like dopamine surging up from the brainstem. It's like sort of the drums, or like fear and the emotions coming from sort of deeper again within the brain. And that's sort of the brass. But then we also have the fine violins that can do wonderful forward planning. And then the conductor of our orchestra is really the frontal pole. Yeah. The bit that I think can do thinking about thinking. And that conductor of our orchestra can stop and say, is this really what we want to be doing? Hang on, guys. Is this the goal we're really going for? Because it can think, can help us think about our own thinking. It can help us reflect, and that can help us make wiser choices. And so again, so if we now think about how we get all of these different brain systems and how they all contribute towards wiser choices. So what is wisdom? So remember I said that, you know, if you're amoebas aren't wise, obviously. If you're amoeba and it's basically trying to, or a fruit fly, or a sparrow, or a mouse, what they're trying to do is link, it's a process that links senses to actions that help it achieve its goals. Yeah. And so wisdom, right, I think we can think about the process of wisdom. And wisdom is about seeing the bigger picture about ourselves in the world so that we can choose actions that help us live better. Yeah. It's basically the fancy human version of what the amoeba does or what the fruit fly does. Yeah. But we have incredible, remarkable capacities that enable us to go far beyond anything any other animal can do, and that enable us to make wiser choices.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why I'm optimistic about the future. Mm. Our incredible capacity as humans for self-knowledge, for self-reflection about ourselves as individuals and ourselves as humanity more broadly.
Well, I think that's one of the most fascinating things about the book, because obviously, as a layman, the stuff about the brain is just almost overwhelming in terms of that. But you write very clearly. It's even someone as scientifically ignorant as I am gets a grasp of what you're writing about there. But as a historian, it's particularly fascinating the examples you use to explain the way that the human brain works. And of course, within, as much of the focus is, we'll go on to peace. I know you like peace, but we're dealing with war at the moment, or potential war. And analogies, examples like May 1940, for example, when you talk about Germany in its battle with France and Britain in May 1940, which is a fascinating example of possible scenarios, paths not taken, mistakes perhaps, and opportunities missed. And I wondered if you could talk about that, because I found it absolutely fascinating historically. And it really genuinely was quite new to me what you were saying, and particularly, obviously, connecting it to the way the human brain works and its capacity.
Yeah. I mean, of course, thank you so much for your kind words. I mean, so the first thing to say, obviously, is that there's not just one simple explanation for something as, you know, the Battle of France, the fact that, right, in May 1940, two armies faced each other, right, on May the 9th, two armies faced each other, and the Allies, the British and the French, they had more trained men, more tanks, more planes, more guns. And we now think, oh, the Germans had better stuff. They didn't have better stuff. A lot of our stuff was just as good, if not better, in some cases. The Allies were materially superior, but within literally in six and a bit weeks of the start of the German onslaught, Hitler's cavalry was clattering up the Champs-Élysées in a victory parade. So why did that happen? It's hard to overstate how important that is. That is, in many ways, you can argue quite reasonably that that is the single biggest turning point in 20th century history, the complete collapse of France, essentially. So why did that happen? So the first thing to say is that the Germans were very good. And it gives me no pleasure to say that, Nazi Germany being very good, because my own relatives fought against them and all the rest of it. And, you know, it was an extremely tough and difficult time.
And this is
not
a moral issue.
No, but they were very, very good at fighting on land. And the reason for that is that you had like panzer leaders like Heinz Guderian, the German panzer leader, and they had been thinking long and hard about how they could combine the technologies of their time, radio, tanks, aeroplanes and so on, how they could combine those technologies of their time with human, really human things like surprise. He literally wrote a book. He published a book and he said there are three key principles. One of the three key principles is surprise. And yet, for some reason, like he published this before World War II, and we clearly they didn't read it enough in Britain and France. But the whole point was is the Germans were brilliant. They had this thing Blitzkrieg, what was later called Blitzkrieg and so on. And in that Blitzkrieg, that was lightning war, very fast war to create surprise and shock in the adversary.
And we forget how innovative that was. We?
Yes.
We look back on it now as an historical, that's what happened, you know, 85 years ago. But it was radically new way of fighting war.
Well, it's an interesting point. In some ways, the British had kind of got there in 1918. And then we forgot it and deliberately chose not to remember all those lessons. And I wish I had time to get into
and
that.
And there's
but
psychological
not,
reasons as well.
There are. And it's very interesting. I was literally at the Army Navy Club having scotch and ginger ale with someone the other evening and discussing exactly this issue. But the Germans are very good. A key thing was they combined the technology of their time with human factors like creating shock and surprise in their adversary. And they did that, and just so they did that, using better ways of decision-making. And they're very linked to the new technologies we have now. The British and American militaries now copy the Germans, essentially, this idea of an intent. So you have the commander's intent, but then you flow down how that intent is achieved down to lower and lower, lower levels, right? Which is called mission command, the British and American militaries now, and it was called Aufstragstaktik, the Germans and so on. Now, why is surprise? So they have these clever ways of making faster and smarter decisions than we did. Now, why is surprise so important? So I talked about how our brain uses models of the world. We have all these models in our brain, an orchestra of models. Now, the way our models work is they're constantly making predictions about how the world is going to be working, right? Because we need to anticipate the future. We constantly need to be anticipating the future. And our models are constantly making predictions about how the world is going to turn out. And then because our models are constantly making predictions, but we need to change those models. Because clearly sometimes, for example, if you're crossing the road in Britain, cars are driving on the left. If you go to America, cars are driving on the right. If you don't change how things are working, you will die. Right, it's quite straightforward.
Well, I had a very good example of that.
Oh, right.
Because I was in Japan.
Yeah.
And being in a foreign country, I automatically change my focus when crossing a road. Because in Japan, it's the same, even though it's a completely foreign country.
Yes.
And I found it was actually more dangerous being in Japan, readapting my model to a foreign country.
Because you were using a heuristic. You were using a simple rule of thumb. And then you stopped and reflected. It's like the same thing. I lived in Washington, D.C., and I'm very used to crossing the road there. And it's very easy to not concentrate and look the wrong way. So a few years ago, I decided, no, Nick, having almost been run over. When I first get to Washington, D.C., and then also when I first get back to London, I always look in both directions and make a big fuss of looking in every conceivable direction when I'm crossing a big crossroads for precisely that reason. We can stop and reflect, right? A mouse is not going to be as smart about doing these things. So a beautiful example of the importance of reflection. But all I say, so we need to change our models of the world. So how do we do that? Our models are constantly making predictions about the world. And when those predictions about the world are wrong, when our expectations are violated, when our expectations are wrong, that's called a prediction error. And that prediction error is so important. That's the learning signal. And so that's what surprise is. Surprise is an example of prediction error. And that's why surprise will always be so crucial in war. And that's what the Germans did. So if you read Ernest May, the famous Harvard historian, the single feature he said was the key reason why the French collapsed was surprise the Germans created. The same thing with Julian Jackson's book, Surprise. And why is surprise always so important? Surprise will always be important because of the brain. It's the brain. Surprise will always be important because of the brain. And obviously, I talk about lots of different ways it predicted. We can talk about lots of different aspects of how we can use this prediction error framework to understand lots of things. But another thing to remember is that the French will to fight collapsed. Mm-hmm. Right? It's something we've avoided thinking about for a long time, and we pretend that the French did a lot of things. And unfortunately, that is not true. It was 6 and a bit weeks from the start of the German onslaught to Hitler's victory parade up the Champs-Élysées. The French did collapse, and they capitulated and they collaborated. In the first 18 months of the occupation, in the whole of Paris, not one German was deliberately killed by the French.
That's an extraordinary
fact. Not one.
Fact.
There are lots of these facts. Now, later on in the war, I hate to say this, but once it became clear that Britain and America were likely to win the war against Nazi Germany, then lots of French did get much more involved. And this is absolutely in no way to say there weren't a small number earlier on of extremely brave French resistance fighters, at least one of whom I discuss at length in the book. But that's not where we actually were, right? And we need to remember this about democracies. France fought badly, very badly. It capitulated and then it collaborated, handed over huge amounts of material completely unscathed to the Germans that was crucial for them to invade Russia the next year, an invasion that cost them 27 million Soviet lives. We need to remember that democracies can make terrible choices.
Yeah.
And why did the French collapse? The French collapsed because their will to fight collapsed. Their will to fight collapsed. And that, again, the will to fight is something that is fundamentally psychological. This is fundamentally in our brains. It is not normal to risk your life. I don't risk my life coming here to this studio today from North London. I don't risk my life in any meaningful sense doing this, right? It's not a normal thing to risk your life. And it's difficult to get people to risk their lives. And in addition to that, it's difficult to get people to kill other people. Because the will to fight involves the will to risk your own life, and it involves the will to fight aggressively. These are things that a lot of people find difficult to do.
And very few people actually do that, even in the theatre of war.
Yeah, this is why not that many people win high awards for bravery. You need to be brave enough. But that doesn't mean, of course, that you're foolhardy, just to say. So, you know, von Clausewitz had this famous thing of this brigadier, right, who's a man of acknowledged bravery, but he still used the natural contours of the ground and the cover, so you're not going to get your shot, because if you're just a fool, if you're just reckless, then you're never going to... Right, so... But you do need the will to fight and risk your life, and you're absolutely right. So there was a famous study done of American World War II soldiers by SLA Marshall, and there's all sorts of, like everything academic, there's like a million things saying he wasn't right and his methods weren't good. But the gist of it is true, corroborated by other sources, which is that even in a stern day, what they described as the stern day's infantry combat, only about a quarter of men would even discharge their rifles. A lot of men would what's called do posturing. They would point their rifles, but not really in a way that it's going to affect the enemy. So I think it was something like a tiny fraction, like 1% of US fighter pilots, you know, in the US Army Air Force, as it was then known, contributed something like 40% of the combat kills. It's a small number of people who are able and willing to effectively kill others. And that is abnormal or unusual, not abnormal, unusual. But we need those people. And when we're now thinking about Russia, we're thinking about if there's a war in East Asia, Xi Jinping decides to invade Taiwan, the balloon goes up in East Asia, Iran decides to take its opportunity against Israel because the Americans physically can't help Israel in the way they normally do. In Europe, Vladimir Putin has got to some kind of, you know, he's reconstituted his military and he will attack. We're not going to stop him by having a nice discussion and persuading him that war is futile. But war, we'd all be better off if nobody went to war.
So you subscribe to Zach Polanski's view that we should just negotiate with
Putin. I mean, but it's like A.A. Milne, the author of Winnie the Pooh, he was an ardent pacifist in the interwar period. And in 1940, he was like, we have to fight Hitler because he's the Antichrist, right? I mean, the Nazis were awful. Now, Vladimir Putin is not a nice man. He's a deeply unpleasant former KGB agent who murders people, like up the road from here. UCH, there was the chap who was poisoned with polonium-210. Mm-hmm. Literally, they had to strip all of the lining of his hospital room out afterwards because he'd irradiated it. They murdered people on the streets of Britain. The Skripals tried to. He's a deeply unpleasant man who did launch a war in 2022. With the greatest respect to Steven Pinker, I'm sure he's definitely is an extremely clever and articulate chap. As he said after Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine in February 2022, something along the lines of, I certainly changed the subjective probability that dictators would use military force to...
It's an admission of sorts.
You know, I mean, really, Professor Pinker, you know, a lot of people were aware that this was a possibility.
Although a lot of people were really reluctant to admit it, I think. I mean, this comes back to the point you made earlier, you know. And it's almost, this is part of the psychology of it, isn't it? You want to put this off, in a way, acknowledging this.
Of course you do. And there are very good reasons for that. We hope for the best. So I remember it was around May or July 2014. It was just after the Little Green Men had gone into Crimea and all the rest of it. And I was doing a tour. I was living in Washington at the time. I came back to Europe and I did a tour of the Foreign Office, you know, met different officials in London and Paris and Berlin. And I was in the Berlin Foreign Office, which is the trendiest, coolest, hippest Foreign Office, Foreign Ministry I've ever been to. You know, hipster cafe and all this stuff. And I was saying to this guy, you know, how do you, like, I was thinking about how do we calibrate, you know, our actions that we're doing against Russia's trying to deter them, whatever. So how do you think about that? And he was like, I won't say who it was, obviously. And he was like, do you know what? We have so much difficulty working out getting all of the people in the EU to agree to everything that we give very little thought, actually, to how it's going to really affect Russian decision making. Mm. We were just living in a different time in which we didn't have to think about any of these things. Mm. Now, I think the Germans in particular, they do feel enormous guilt, understandably so, because what they unleashed in Eastern Europe, I mean,
grotesque.
Hitler's plan for Moscow was to turn into a giant lake. Mm. I mean, he was an absolutely awful guy, Hitler. Obviously, this is not a controversial view, but he was a nasty man. Now, he had those horrible ideas, and the Germans pursued those for years and fought doggedly. It's important to remember, D-Day in the West
just
was
how
succeeded,
long it took.
Right, D-Day in the West succeeded in June 1944, and Operation Bagration with the Soviet Russian forces eviscerated the German armies in the east. Mm. And still, after both of those had succeeded, right, were clearly successful, the Germans fought. There was no chance Germany was going to win at that point. And the Germans fought on for longer than France lasted in the entire war. Right? It was extremely difficult to beat the Germans. We have to remember the Germans fought very hard, and it wasn't just Adolf Hitler. The Germans do feel guilt for that. And it's good. I go on holiday to Germany. I like Germany. It's a wonderful country. And it's, you know, has been remade in important ways. Mm. There's a lot of guilt. But in addition to that, there's also fear. They fear the Russians. The Russians were not very kind to the Germans, one can say, for understandable reasons.
And this is not dissimilar to the point you make about France in 1939, which is a path not taken, in a way. While the Germans are invading Poland, the forces have moved east. There is an opportunity for France there to move into the West, to neutralise, at least to some extent, Germany's ambitions in the West. But it's a path not taken.
Yeah, I mean...
And for similar reasons, I imagine, fear, guilt, the remembrance of the First World War, you know, Verdun, the terrible legacy of that war. There's a perfectly understandable reluctance there.
It is understandable, and I think this is a really great example, though. So Hitler invades Poland, essentially right at the beginning of September. Britain and France declare war on... And bear in mind, it's another really important thing almost nobody knows. Only Britain and, you know, its Commonwealth and Empire and so on, and France and its equivalent, declared war on Nazi Germany for invading Poland. The Belgians didn't, the Danes didn't, the Swedes didn't, the Norwegians didn't. None of those other countries, none of those small countries... None of them, which were really important. It's very important to remember this. A lot of the reason that the Battle of France was a catastrophe for the Allies was because we sent our best troops up into Belgium and the Netherlands, and they were cut off by the German panzers. And that's why we then had Dunkirk and all the rest of it. It was because the Dutch and the Belgians simply did not... They only got into the war when they were literally invaded on May the 10th, 1940. You can see I'm a little bit irritated about that because it's like most people don't know any of this. No. And it's like... Do you know how many Danes and Germans died in the invasion of Denmark in April 1940? I don't know if you know this. Okay, this is according to Martin Gilbert's book. So Martin Gilbert is a pretty reputable historian. Zero. Zero. Nobody died on either side because the Danes did not fight back at all. they gave up literally that morning. Now, I'm not saying the Danes could have held off the Wehrmacht, but those smaller countries are really important. That was an important path not taken, and we need to remember that now. It can't all be up to Britain and France, because A, that clearly didn't pan out that brilliantly, did it, in 1940. But in addition to that, it's so important that all countries that can play a part do play a part. But you're absolutely right. Another thing that didn't
and
happen...
And that's a lesson about Ukraine as well.
Yeah, and another thing, you're absolutely right, and I think this is a really important thing about how we plan for the future. So the problem is that in September 1939, Hitler's key panzer divisions were off in the east invading Poland. So Heinz Guderian, his troops, his panzers, they were off there in the east. Also, a lot of things didn't work very well. The Germans simply got some stuff wrong. They'd been training, actually, interestingly, in Soviet Russia, but that's a different discussion, about how to do panzer manoeuvres. They weren't very good at crossing rivers in Poland. Poland's full of rivers. Crucial the next year, they trained furiously in the remaining months. Anyway, got too excited there about crossing rivers. But the point is that there was a time period where it was a relatively weak force in the West defending Germany. Britain and France could have struck east and taken the key German industrial area, the Ruhr. We could have done that. There was nothing really preventing us from doing that. And then it would have been a war of attrition between us and them. And we would have probably won, because we would have had like the industrial heartland. Instead of that, we did not do that. We did not invade. It was a live and let live. It was like, don't shoot at them, because do you know why? If we shoot at them, then they might shoot at us. We were dropping leaflets on them because we didn't want to upset them, essentially. We weren't dropping bombs on almost any part of Germany. Very important to remember. Now, why did we do that? A lot of that is because we think forwards into the future, a decision tree going into the future. And sometimes when there is a really unpleasant thing early on in that decision tree, then we just ignore everything that goes behind it, even though that's where some of the best outcomes can be. Sometimes it's good to your spouse to have a, or partner to have a discussion, an awkward discussion. It's not a pleasant thing to do, but then the best outcomes lay beyond that, right? Yeah. Or with your boss or whoever it might be. And we prune this decision tree. And that's brilliant. This is the kind of clever thing that means that your brain, Paul, and this is not because you're not a clever guy, but just because all human brains work on the wattage of a dim incandescent light bulb.
No, I was absolutely fascinated by that. It's 20 watts or something.
It's pretty low. It's pretty low. But even that is a big chunk of all of every sandwich you eat. A big chunk of that sandwich is there to power your like weirdly enormous brain for like almost every other animal. But we have to use these shortcuts. We have to. It's impossible that we won't use these shortcuts. We have our models of the world. Our models of the world are really great, but they're only ever partial representations of the world. They're always limited in absolutely fundamental ways. One of these things is pruning. We prune these unfortunate bits of our decision tree away. And that's what the French did. They did not think, if we attack, yes, that will be more uncomfortable in the short term, but it will be a much better long-term outcome. They didn't do that. It was a path untaken, like so many others. And literally tens of millions of people, in my opinion, died because we were not aggressive enough.
Let's have a look at AI, because you've obviously been involved in that. Just talk us about the applications that you think AI has for conflict, but also for the resolution of conflicts, as well as about how we navigate this new world. And it is very much a new world. I mean, you've been there pretty much since the beginning, but it is new. And what might be the consequences for conflict, but also for peace?
Yeah. I mean, so the first things, so AI, there are kind of two major sets of challenges people discuss when they're thinking about AI and conflict. So one is more, you know, AI that can help you do things like, for example, there was Project Maven, which was the famous US project, which was identifying things, you know, looking at visual information from drones or whatever, and identifying things that human analysts should look at. So things like that will help faster decision making and all that kind of stuff. And that's the one I'm going to focus on most. But then there's a separate thing, which is about superintelligence. So you, for example, Paul, are a general intelligence. If I could create you in AI, I'd be the most famous scientist in the world, because you have like a whole suite of human level capabilities. You can do things like fold a basket of clothes in the laundry, which is superior to any top of the flight. You would beat any top flight robot at folding laundry. And you have a whole suite of human level capabilities. And that's what general intelligence is. And then people think, well, what if we get to a super intelligence? This is something that then becomes even better than a human. So I'm going to just talk about that very briefly first. So people then worry, well, we'll get to this super intelligence and then we're all doomed, right? Because it will overtake us. It will be.
This is the alignment model.
Well, I don't really agree with alignment. So there's the normal AI stuff they're using on the battlefield right today in Ukraine. Yep. They're planning to use in Taiwan Strait or whatever. And then there's a separate thing, which is about superintelligence, where you get an AI that becomes, it learns, it rapidly just becomes so much more intelligent than any human being that it can completely manipulate us. And then it will trick us, for example, into destroying us using with nuclear weapons. Yep. A couple of things about that. One, as I remember chatting with a friend of mine in Washington, he was like, do you know, like when people talk about AI and it will like trick us into a nuclear war or whatever and all kill ourselves, he was like, do they know how difficult it is to overthrow a government? And this is the guy who clearly had some experience in doing related things. And it's like, the idea that AI is going to be so awesome at this. I mean, the Americans had awesome technology and they couldn't beat the Taliban. No. I'm not as worried about the superintelligence manipulating us as a lot of others. And I think you talk about alignments. The idea is that once you get to this level of superintelligence, how can you get it to align with our values? Mm. So, for example, you don't want it to end up turning the whole world into... If you tell it to build paperclips, you don't want it to turn the whole world into like fodder for paperclip manufacture, right? And killing every human helps it achieve its goal of paperclip manufacturing. Right, that's a classic example. And so every AI tries to achieve an objective because it is fundamentally just like a human brain. And so how can you get that AI to align with our objectives for the world of humanity? And I don't think that's really possible in important ways because, A, what are objectives? What is the purpose of your life, Paul? What is the purpose of my life? Mm. What are the purposes, is more accurate, of our lives?
Well, humanity spends a lot of time considering
We do, and we don't all agree with each other. You'd be amazed. From a more historical perspective, people haven't always completely agreed on what the purpose of life is and how everything should be organised. So I'm not sure we would get to that point where we could program this into the computer anyway. Mm. And even if we did, how do we know that it's like going to achieve that goal in a way that is good for us? What are the means for it to achieve those ends? Would have, even if we could specify them, which I don't think we really could very clearly. So I think that actually what we need to do is we need to build wiser AI. So we understand how humans can make wiser decisions. And again, it's about seeing the bigger picture about ourselves in the world so that we can choose actions that help us achieve our goals. That involves things like asking, what is our goal? Is this the correct goal? What are we trying to achieve? We're learning a lot about the process, about how wisdom occurs in the human brain. And I think that is what we need to program into our super intelligent AI, right? Build super intelligent AI so that it can make wiser choices. It can be more of a Nelson Mandela or a Winston Churchill than an Adolf Hitler AI, right? Yeah. That's the gist of the thing.
No. But even then, there's still human interaction there with it.
Yeah, well, we don't know because, I mean, this is the thing. So no one's ever built a super intelligent AI. Mm. If we build it, like, what will it be connected to? How will it communicate with us? How many of them will there be? Mm. Right? What will it be its physical instantiation in the world? What will it be connected to? Mm. Yes, it can manipulate us. It can do all sorts of stuff. But, you know, how will it do all of that? I mean, anyway, super intelligence, alignment. Actually, I think we need to go for wiser AI. And I'm not as worried about that as a lot of people are.
Yeah.
Talk about that a bit more if we have time. But now let's look about, like, everyday military AI, good old everyday military AI. A couple of months ago was the first report in public ever of a swarm of robots, and these were in Ukraine, and they decided themselves, they were given a target by a human commander, they decided amongst themselves how they would apply lethal force to that target. It's the first time this has ever happened, publicly reported. So we're already getting to the point where there are now swarms of AI-enabled drones, so that they could be ground, air, and so on. And the Ukrainians are using ground, air combinations of drones and all sorts of things now. So now, what does that mean? Ukraine and Russia are hugely technologically inferior as science and technology powers to America and China. If there was certainly a prolonged war between America and China, that you will get to, I mean, it's extremely unlikely you're not going to get to swarm-on-swarm action. It will be swarm-on-swarm. There'll be relatively small numbers of... So I'm sure you know Sir Michael Howard. He had this idea of, like, you know, part of World War II, key parts of World War II were battles between dueling technologists, which I loved his phrase. Dueling. So you had the Battle of Britain, relatively small numbers of pilots on each side and controllers, and they were dueling with the absolute cutting-edge technologies of their time. Mm. Couldn't be more cutting-edge than radar and Spitfires and Messerschmitts and stuff. I think that's all we'll have. We'll have battles of dueling technologists. It'll be swarm-on-swarm action of drones. Now, what does that tell us? I think that that immediately tells us that the idea that humans can ever be what's called in the loop, so where a human sits, every decision made by that swarm of drones, a human will say, yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, you can go ahead with that. Or no, don't do that. The idea that that's going to be feasible for me is absolutely impossible. Because if you do that, you will just lose. The idea that every meaningful decision, like a human will be in the loop to say yay or nay to that, is just literally, it's not going to happen. Mm. Because any side that did that would just lose. So humans will sit on top of, we won't be in the loop, humans will be sitting on top of these swarms of drones. And they will be communicating with that swarm of drones. Now, the swarm drone is going to be saying what it wants to do, what it's perceiving, what it's understanding about the world. And it'll be communicating that to the human controller, commander. And the human will also be giving its intent. So we're back to Heinz Guderian and the Panzer orders and mission commander stuff, right? Be giving its intent to that swarm of drones. So you're going to have two-way communication. And it'll be high bandwidth communication. So it will be like tone of voice probably by this point, and like facial expressions and all the rest of it, as well as the specific words and the context and meaning of those words. In all these ways, there will be humans communicating with these swarms, and how we can best communicate will depend on understanding the human and how humans communicate every bit as much as the swarm of drones. And so that, for example, will include how confident those drones are. Those drones will have to basically communicate their metacognition, their thinking about thinking, to the human in ways that humans understand.
This will be analogous to morale.
Well, it's a good point. I mean, in a sense, so what is an emotion? Emotion is a broad response to a particular stimulus that is like happiness. It's things like happiness or fear or anger.
Or resolve or something.
Now, if I see like my kid do a nice thing and he's happy and whatever, I'm like, oh, that's nice. I feel happiness. And it's a broad response. It's like a common currency in the brain across a wide range of different brain systems. Or fear. Good God, that something terrible is going to happen, right? It's a broad thing. And yes, machines will have fear. Machines will have happiness.
But they won't have pain.
Well, they will, because what is pain? Pain is simply a tissue alert system in the brain. It's saying, you know, there is a tissue alert. There is tissue damage. I've treated many, many, many people who don't have proper, so diabetic feet, right? You don't have proper pain. You don't feel pain properly. And so you just injure yourself. You literally walk around your house and you accidentally, you just damage your foot because you're constantly, you're not feeling pain. So you don't, it's not helpful. Now, we have our models sitting in the middle of pain, right? So for example, the reason why we don't just have a simple senses coming in and then to actions going out, is we have the model sitting in there so we can react flexibly. So with pain, for example, actually people who are shot will often describe a bullet as like a being hit by a lump of mud or a prodding finger. And the reason for that is that if you're a Spitfire pilot and you're flying your plane and you're trying to take down a German bomber and then suddenly you get hit by a bullet, if you just went ow and like then were just, you know, paralyzed with pain, I mean, that you wouldn't enable the most useful response. Instead, our brain can, our model, right, enables us to dial down that pain so that we can then decide, do we continue the attack on the bomber? Do we alert our comrades there are Messerschmitts behind us or whatever it might be, right? Do we bail out? So yes, I think that machines will have fear and machines will have pain. They will have all of these things. They won't be the same as ours precisely.
But they will
at
have
all.
The same function.
Yeah, because like, for example, imagine you have like a mining robot and it feels it's like slipping in some non-distinct way down a hill. It will need some rapid response. It's not gonna, like, so in your brain now, Paul, you have things that can respond rapidly at the speed of relevance, to use that classic American military term from a few years ago. If suddenly there was a fire alarm, like stuff would occur and we would like leap out. If someone like came towards us, a flash of steel or a car going the wrong way down the road, we would have systems in our brain that can react at the speed of relevance to that. But then equally, you can sit there and have a good old think about stuff for planning months, years ahead. We have multiple systems that help us survive in different ways. And it's exactly the same. It will be identical for sophisticated robots in the near future. Mm-hmm. And they're already obviously trying to build all these things. And all of those robots will have an orchestra of robot brain systems that combine together and are integrated together to enable that robot to function effectively. So just return to these swarms of drones. Humans will be on top, they'll be communicating. And how well we can communicate is going to be really crucial to how effective they are militarily. But you can also think about the morality, right? So effective military don't just destroy regardless of how much collateral damage they cause. They try and keep things proportional. Now, effective military like Mao Zedong, for example, the Red Army, and Zhu De, who was his sort of like key military leader in the early part of in the Civil War and so on. you know, they had these ideas that their troops should treat local populations fairly. Their troops should win over the hearts and minds, essentially, of the populace within which they operated. And so then they would simply get more help and support from those populations than with the warlord armies they, you know, they were fighting against. And that worked brilliantly. It will be exactly the same type of thing with these new swarms of drones. And there will be a slider, for example, or a set of sliders that say, a bit like courageous restraint in Iraq and Afghanistan. How much should the soldiers, how much should the drones protect the soldiers, for example, on a patrol, and how much should the drones protect the local population? Mm. Right, and you will set a slider for that.
And these are the same calculations as in...
Yeah, and this is exactly how... Now, we're learning a lot about how humans make moral decisions, but how we do these things. There's a lot about that, how we do this in the brain. And we can now write these down mathematically, and we can program these into these swarms, because the swarms will be doing a lot of things autonomously as well. So we need to understand how we are going to be programming these things in. The idea that we're not going to have a slider... So a lot of people criticised the Israelis in Gaza with things like Where's Daddy and Lavender and so on, for saying we are prepared to kill X number of civilians if we get one top Hamas commander. Now, obviously that we can have a whole discussion. If you get down to the point of saying we are never prepared to kill any civilians to hit a top Hamas commander, you're never going to hit any top Hamas commanders. And no military can ever operate like that fundamentally in a real war. Certainly a war between great powers. The British, for example, gave them no pleasure. But in World War II, there were decisions, you know, in the run-up to D-Day, they had to bomb French railways, and that killed French civilians. But they had to do that to stop the German panzers throwing them back into the sea. That's just the way it was.
These are the terrible calculations that generals have to make.
Now, these things are going to be explicitly programmed into AI, and there will be a slider or panel of sliders that will go from 0 to 1. So, Brigadier Lay, why did you put the slider for your thing at 0.3? Mm. Right, that in the after-action discussion of 10 years later when you're being criticised at some kind of... Right? Or Major Lay, or Sergeant Lay. This is the reality of where we're going to get to. And we need to realise this is what's going to happen. And I think that how we build these AI systems will in large part be built on how we understand human brains operate, and that will give us a huge edge. In addition to that, and as I said earlier, like, remember, both last year's Nobel Prizes in AI came for people who worked deeply on the brain. They were car-carrying people who worked on the brain. Jeffrey Hinton said, I was trying to create an electronic brain to all intents and purposes. We can learn a huge amount about AI from how the brain works. And if we can harness AI both for winning wars but also for making peace, then a more peaceful world, then, you know, we also have to understand how human brains work and how humans will interact with these AIs so that they can act in a with the type of morality that we would want them to act. So I know I haven't really got onto the whole peace and AI thing, but I'm worried that we've reached the very end of the thing.
Yes, no, I mean, we've covered so much ground. Well, you've covered so much ground, I should say. It's extraordinary. Just one last thing.
Yeah.
Because you said, you know, we like peace. We're optimists. Give me good grounds to be an optimist on this. Why are you an optimist?
Look, I mean, I'm an optimist because I think we have more knowledge of ourselves as humans than anyone has ever had before. At the beginning of my book is a picture of my great-uncle Sydney, who fought in World War II for a number of years. He's right there from right at the beginning. He was a British tank commander, and he won a Military Cross, which is a high award for bravery. Towards the end, and he was in Italy. He was in Operation Torch in North Africa, and he was in Italy right until, you know, April 1945. And the thing is, just to say, that's also an example. You know, I remember him from when I was a small boy, and he used to push me around in his wheelbarrow in our garden, in his garden, rather, down near Brighton. He was a happy man. Humans are enormously resilient. And then, you know, the picture at the beginning is of him at his 100th birthday, surrounded by loads of family members who were just, you know, thought he was great. And he was a happy guy, and it was wonderful. And he's there holding he's there with my wife and holding my son, right? He was a baby at the time. And the thing is that hopefully we can, my wife and I, our generation, we can know more than he knew, because we know so much more about ourselves, and we have more history to look at. We have better understanding of, you know, human nature from things like neuroscience and all sorts of other things than he could ever have accessed. And hopefully my son Hugo, you know, who's in there, and my daughter Cece, they can know more than we ever knew. Yes, our capacity for destruction and creating new fiendish ways of doing terrible things to each other, it spirals upwards. But so does our understanding of ourselves. And it is true that the more I learn about humans, the more remarkable and the more I like humans. And we can think about our own thinking. We can stop and reflect. We can invent new ways to operate. We can invent new ways to create peace. And we do. The world is objectively, this is one area where I agree with Steven Pinker. Right? I think the world is becoming, broadly speaking, more peaceful between societies and within societies. Now, that doesn't mean, and this is why Steven Pinker's ideas are dangerously incomplete, that doesn't mean that wars can't break out. They can break out, and they almost certainly will break out. We can never abolish war, just as we can never abolish crime, and we can never abolish unpleasant things happen within our societies. But actually, the broad sweep is cumulative. It's improving. The world is getting better. Will it ever be perfect? No. Is it getting better? Yes. And that is why I'm optimistic. We can make a more peaceful, not perfectly peaceful, because it's not possible, but we can, and we have, and I hope that we will, make a more peaceful world through self-knowledge. And that is why I'm optimistic about the future.
Well, that's nice to end on a positive note. It's also nice to think that every time I walk through Queen Square, which I do many, many times on a daily basis, that it's one of the great hives of knowledge and innovation of our times.
It's incredibly exciting. Yeah. It is a really exciting place to work.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable. Well, Nicholas Wright's book, Warhead, How the Brain Shapes War and War Shapes the Brain, is published by Macmillan, and it's available now. And thank you very much, Dr. Wright. That was a fantastic survey. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.